Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. Well, today in the second hour of the show, we're going to be returning to the vexed question of climate change, climate alarmism, and the incredibly polarised debate on that. Now, one of the observations that I've made, and others have noticed as well, is that many experts outside the very narrow field of climate science, experts in more hard sciences like geology and physics, tend to often not go down the direction of the very, very alarmist and very, very politically hyped views about what is the likely outcomes of climate over the near future. And many of these people are actually quite expert in fields that are very connected with science, like geology, paleoclimate, atmospheric physics. And it really does highlight the politicized nature of climate science itself, with climate scientists obviously being under a lot of pressure to deliver certain results, and with that whole infrastructure being tailored to government policy. So on today's show, I'm actually welcoming a guest, Professor Bob Carter, who's been on the show before. And Bob Carter is a geologist and an expert in paleoclimate, a marine geologist, a paleontologist, and a stratigrapher. And Professor Carter has been a very, very vocal critic and a real stalwart in the struggle to maintain a truly skeptical point of view about climate science, and a view that's actually informed by the hard sciences, by research that is not connected to that very, very heavily politically influenced field of climate science. So having said that, let me welcome Bob Carter back to the show. Are you there, Bob?
Hello, Herwood. It's very nice to be here again, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, look, it's a great pleasure, and I really enjoyed our previous discussion. And you've had a real great weight on your shoulders as being one of the few highly expert Australian skeptics to counter the endless sort of wave after wave of government propaganda. And it's very important, I think, that we all understand that the difficulty that that people like you have faced. And there's a lot of details I want to go in the show about some of the latest research coming through from new organizations like the Non-Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change. But Bob, can you just give us a feel of what it's like being someone in your shoes?
Well, I live in Townsville in the tropics, so I don't actually wear shoes very often, Aaron.
Yeah, sure.
But you say a great weight on the shoulders. In one sense, that's true. In another sense, it's not true, because there are many, many more scientists who disagree with the hype and the alarmism and the propaganda that you refer to than agree with it. But you do not hear from them. And the reason you do not hear from them is because it is professional suicide for a career scientist who's still employed in a scientific organization to be critical of the dangerous global warming hypothesis in public. So when you say I'm one of the few Australian people that the public hear from, that is true. And the other people who the public hear from are like me, elderly and retired. And that means we cannot be intimidated. But it's very important that the public understand that there are literally hundreds of qualified scientists in Australia and thousands to tens of thousands worldwide who simply do not accept the climate change propaganda that the Greens, the non-governmental organisations, institutions like the Climate Institute, a lobby group based in Sydney, and of course big business, especially the financial business and those that are involved in manufacturing wind farms or solar panels. All of these people are beneficiaries of the climate scare, and they dominate the discussion in the daily media. You do not hear from many scientists because most scientists can't speak up because they're employed and they're intimidated against speaking up, and secondly, because the media, with one or two shining exceptions, of which your program is one, simply will not present this issue in a balanced way. They run the press releases from the alarmist organizations, and they give virtually no opportunity to qualified independent scientists to put those results in context.
Absolutely. So, well, let's have a look now at the latest release of a report that's described as the Non-Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which came out in September of 2013, Climate Change Reconsidered to Physical Science. Now, this report contains vast contributions from these people that you say that they're certainly looking through the document. There are many, many, many scientific contributors. So this book, a compendium of the research of all of these scientists who are not getting a public hearing. Is that right?
Yes, and it's largely made up, because the authorship is international, so it's largely made up of people like me who are elderly and retired.
Indeed.
Or in some other way are not able to be intimidated in their work situation. But let me back up a little.
Yeah.
Some part of that title will sound familiar to your listeners. It's the IPCC part, which stands for not the International Panel on Climate Change, which many people think that it does,
yeah,
but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And that is the body that the United Nations set up in 1988 to advise world governments on this issue. And it cannot be stressed too often that that body is part of the United Nations. It is a political body accountable to politicians. Sure, it's advised by scientists. Sure, some of those scientists are excellent research scientists. But the IPCC itself was set up to advise not on climate change in the generality of things, but on the express topic of human carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions as related to dangerous global warming. So the IPCC starts off with a hypothesis, or an idea, a testable idea. And that idea is that human greenhouse gas emissions are causing dangerous global warming. Okay. Now, the NIPCC was set up, and the I does not stand for intergovernmental. As you've read out, it stands for international. So the NIPCC is the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change. And it's made up of scientists. It's not a political body. It's independent. It's funded by family foundation contributions in the United States. There is no industry money involved in supporting it at all. So what both the NIPCC and the IPCC do is they look at the same set of published scientific literature. Neither of the bodies do scientific research as such, though the scientists involved are often doing their own research on the side. But working for those organizations, their job is not to do new research. It is rather to summarize the research that's in the established scientific literature. So the NIPCC starts off with a different hypothesis. It starts off with what is called the null hypothesis, which in science, every scientist has to have when he or she is examining a problem. And the null hypothesis is the simplest interpretation of the facts. So whereas the IPCC starts off by presuming that human greenhouse gas emissions cause dangerous global warming, the NIPCC starts out by saying the changes that we observe, because we do observe them the whole time around us in climate, and that we know from geology have happened through history, those changes are due to natural climate variability. So those two groups have those fundamentally different approaches. And in both cases, they've got a hypothesis, and the job of any independent scientist or adjudicator is to say, well, does the data support the hypothesis? So let me read to you now from the recent NIPCC report you referred to.
Sure.
The first major conclusion, having examined the same corpus of scientific literature that the IPCC has examined. And the conclusion is this, and I quote, "We conclude neither the rate nor the magnitude of the reported late 20th century surface warming between 1979 and 2000 lay outside normal natural variability, nor was it in any way unusual compared to earlier episodes in Earth's climatic history." So just think about that conclusion. That is a diametrically opposed conclusion to the IPCC's. Furthermore, the science or the papers that are being used to support this conclusion are a test of the IPCC's hypothesis, which is that human greenhouse gas emissions are causing dangerous warming. Well, the answer is, let's look at the literature, and we find there is no evidence for that whatsoever.
And, you know, your observation there about the terminology in the naming of the organisations really says so much, doesn't it? The fact that it is actually intergovernmental rather than international, I just think that's a really important point to highlight, is that we're actually talking here about an organisation that is about policy primarily. Would that be correct? I mean, it seems that the intergovernmental panel is about informing policy, and it simply accepts what data is brought to it, and the mechanisms by which that data is brought to it are somewhat under question. But then this organization simply informs governments.
Yes, that's absolutely right. The point is, there's a fundamental difference of, you could say, scientific philosophy between the way the two organizations function. But in fact, one of them is scientific and the other isn't. The IPCC collects and examines information in order to prove their hypothesis that is consistent with the hypothesis. They go out the whole time and run computer models and are always looking for this evidence that will support or prove their hypothesis. And they produce these huge volumes every 5 years full of what they claim is evidence for their hypothesis. Now, any elementary science student knows you cannot prove a hypothesis. No matter how many facts you have that are consistent with your idea, as Einstein says, it only needs one fact to disprove it. So whereas the IPCC is all about gathering evidence for, the NIPCC examines information in order to try to disprove its null hypothesis. We are trying to show that present-day climate change is outside of natural variability, and we cannot do it. There is no scientific literature that establishes that fact. Climate is variable, as weather is variable. Everybody knows this. They look outside the window and they go to work and home every day, and they live in a varying environment. In order for there to be a problem that governments should be worrying about, the very first thing you have to be able to do is show that somehow the weather or the climate is stepping outside the bounds of natural variability.
Absolutely. We're just going to break. Professor Carter, we're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Really interesting show today. We're talking about the non-intergovernmental panel on climate change. Don't go away.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now.
Welcome back. You are with Truth News Radio. My guest today is Professor Bob Carter, an expert in marine geology and paleoclimate research and stratigraphy, and a man who really understands deep time, the climate over vast periods of time, unlike the sort of narrow research that we see with climate science, which is largely based on computer models and which often doesn't really take a great interest in that great that goes back through the history of the Earth. Bob Carter, could we briefly, before moving on, I would actually would like to focus a little more on this concept that you were highlighting before the break about the null hypothesis. Now, some of our listeners are scientifically trained, some of them are not, and this may be a little bit of a new concept to them. I'm just reading here from a Wikipedia entry on this topic, and the null hypothesis is described as referring to a general and default position that there is no relationship between two measured phenomena, or that the potential, actually that's probably a bad example there, but let's just start with that there is no relationship between two measured phenomena. And what you're talking about, Bob, is the relationship there that you've established between greenhouse gases and climate. I'll hand it over to you. I've probably said that wrongly. Please take over from me.
Well, Wikipedia is such a mixed bag, isn't it? Sometimes it's really outstanding. Yeah. And other times, including what you've just read me, though admittedly that's out of context, it doesn't sound a very clear explanation to me, because a null hypothesis could equally be that there is a relationship between two phenomena. The key point about the null hypothesis is it's the simplest interpretation of the facts. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true, in inverted commas. It just means that given a set of facts, the simplest interpretation is the scientific null hypothesis that you set up to start with, and you proceed from there.
Right.
Getting back to where we were before the break, I said that there's now been, since 1988, we've had about 25 years or so time, more than $100 billion has been expended on scientific research and other matters relating to this global warming issue. And what we find is that over that period of time, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up by 20% since 1979. 20%. That's a big increase. It's a fifth. So carbon dioxide has gone up 20% since 1979. But I'm looking at on my computer screen right at the moment at a graph that you asked me about, which is the graph of global sea ice volume around Antarctica and the Arctic, summed into one global, because we're talking about global warming here, or global cooling, one global diagram. And it happens that that graph starts in 1979. And why is that? That's because that's when the first satellites were put up. So we've only got an accurate measure of the area of global sea ice since 1979. Now, for reasons I'll get on to and explain in a moment, I don't actually think this data is very relevant to climate change anyway. But if you want to argue that it is relevant to climate change, in terms of the IPCC's hypothesis that dangerous global warming is being caused by human carbon dioxide emissions, you have to explain why the global ice area now, sea ice area, in 2013 is the same as it was in 1979. So that's 34 years of record, a 20% increase in carbon dioxide, and no change in global sea ice area. That's a test of the IPCC's hypothesis, and the hypothesis fails that test.
Now,
here's another similar test, which is you've heard a lot of talk recently about a pause in global warming. Now, most of the people using that term are astrologers, not scientists, because they think they can see the future. We do not know there's been a pause in global warming, because whether there's been a pause or not depends upon whether it now starts warming again or cooling from now on. We don't know that.
Yeah.
What we do know is that global warming stopped in 1997. There has been no warming for the last 17 years. That's not a pause unless you're an astrologer. To a scientist, it's a fact. Global warming stopped in 1997. Now, 1997 is 17 years ago, roughly. And since then, we've had an 8% increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide. So 8% increase in carbon dioxide, no global warming. That's a second test of the IPCC's hypothesis, and it fails again. And before I let you stop me, which you should do, one other comment about that, which is that 8% of extra carbon dioxide that's gone into the atmosphere since 1997 and which has caused no measurable warming that we can detect, that 8% of carbon dioxide increase represents 33% of all the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution started. So it's a gigantic increase, a 33% increase in the amount of carbon dioxide since the Industrial Revolution, and no warming. And yet the newspapers and the IPCC and the government and the lobby groups are still running around pretending that there's something to be scientifically worried about.
Now, there's a couple of interesting points in what you said, and one of them that really strikes me most is that most people who've been getting their news from any mainstream source would be totally amazed to hear you say that sea ice extent is the same as it was in 1979. And this gets back to another topic, which is one of the main things we talk about on this show, is the way in which the media is continually creating a kind of a false impression in the minds of people about what the actual facts even are. So, I mean, it actually really would be quite surprising to many people to hear you say that sea ice hasn't actually increased, because all we ever seem to hear about when they talk about the Arctic or the South Pole or Antarctica is the terrible problem of loss of ice. And yet here you are saying sea ice is the same. It's like we're in alternate universes or something.
Well, we are. And just addressing quickly the point about the newspapers, you and I both know why they report things that way. It's because they have to sell advertising, and that means they have to get people to read the newspaper, and you can't get people to read good news. They only want to read bad news, basically. So, and I'm not being sarcastic. That is the reality of the way the media industry works. So it's Indeed. Easily understandable why the media do that.
But, of course, there has been some fluctuations in Arctic ice, have there not? And for a period of a few years around after 2000, there was actually a decrease in ice in the Arctic. Obviously, these changes occur every year. There's constant fluctuations. What you're talking about is looking at it overall from one point in time to another point in time.
Yes, you're quite right.
Yeah.
And every time that there was a decrease in Arctic sea ice during the earlier part of this century, there'd be doom and gloom in all the newspapers. And then the next summer, the sea ice recovers, and the newspapers don't mention that, of course. But at the same time, that the Arctic sea ice is still at the moment just slightly below its long-term average. So Antarctic sea ice has reached an all-time record. And when you average those two things out, you find that global sea ice is about the same as it was in 1979. Now, the other thing about that is that the two poles are clearly behaving in different fashions. In other words, sea ice has been melting a bit in the northern hemisphere and increasing in the southern hemisphere. There's absolutely nothing in the IPCC's explanation of global warming, that explains why that should be the case. According to the computer models, ice should be melting at both poles. So that's a third test of the IPCC's hypothesis, and it fails again. The IPCC says the ice should be melting at both poles. Well, it quite simply isn't. And the reason that your listeners and the readers of the Australian media don't know those facts is because the newspapers determinedly will not report them. They will only report the green scare stories that we see in the paper every day.
Absolutely. I'd also like to talk a bit about the land ice in Antarctica, because that's been another topic of a lot of scientific research and a lot of alarmism. We are going to break. We'll be discussing that when we come back. I'm with Professor Bob Carter. Don't go away. Important show. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. My guest today is Bob Carter, an expert in geology and stratigraphy and paleoclimate. Bob, we were talking there before the break about sea ice, and you made some very important observations there about the fact that there has not been an increase in sea ice since the measurements have in fact begun. Could we talk a little about the land ice in Antarctica? Because that's it's a different type of ice. Obviously, it's formed from precipitation. What is your understanding of the overall extent of ice on land in Antarctica?
Before I answer that, and I will, yeah. I'd just like to pick up one word, phrase you used and relate it to the sea ice we were talking about, and it's this, that there's been no change in 30 years, or 34 years to be precise. Well, hooray, Henry, what's so special about 34 years? That's not even a heartbeat of climate change time. Don't ask me, ask the meteorologists, and they will tell you that for statistical reasons, there's no profound science behind this. It was decided back in the early 20th century that climate would be defined as different from weather. It's the sort of the average, the long-term average of weather. And so they said, well, what's long-term? What do we do? Oh, 30 years, somebody said. Let's take a 30-year period, and we'll average all the temperature measurements for Sydney heads, let's say, for those 30 years, and then we come up with a single number. 15.7 degrees is the average temperature over those 30 years. That, by definition, is the climatic temperature for Sydney at that 30-year point in time. Okay, so we need 30 years of measurements to establish one climate data point. Would you like to explain to me how 34 years of measurement of sea ice area can in any way, shape or form whatsoever be used to detect a climate change?
Yes, it's nowhere near enough information to detect a trend, is it? I mean,
It's absurd, Hereward.
Yeah.
And virtually all the scares that you hear in the paper about global warming are subject to this same fundamental criticism. They're describing weather variability. They have nothing to do necessarily with long-term climate change. Let me use that statement to lead into the second summary paragraph I want to read to you from the NIPCC report. Remember, the first conclusion was that the present-day temperature change and the late 20th century warming do not fall outside natural variability. The second conclusion, and I'm quoting now from the NIPCC, was this: we conclude no unambiguous evidence exists for adverse changes to the global environment caused by human-related carbon dioxide emissions. In particular, the cryosphere, that's ice, is not melting at an enhanced rate. Sea level rise is not accelerating. No systematic changes have been documented in evaporation or rainfall, or in the magnitude or intensity of extreme meteorological events, and an increased release of methane into the atmosphere from permafrost or subseabed gas hydrates is unlikely. So there you have it. And the reason that for that statement is that all the changes we see and that the wailing goes on about in the newspapers are relating to natural weather and climate variability. They have nothing to do with long-term climate change because the scientists involved are not looking in general at the records of long-term climate change because it's the geologists that do that. So my comment to you about the sea ice, and the same applies to what I'll now say about the ice caps themselves, is simply this, that even if we know accurately what they're doing over the last 10, 20, 30 years, that doesn't tell us anything about climate change. It tells us about weather variability.
Absolutely. That's such an important point. And it's difficult, you know, doing a show like this, because what I find I'm trying to do is counteract information that comes through the media that is not substantiated or seems to be false. But quite often there's a deeper issue. And what you're talking about there is the deeper and more important issue is that the whole way it's framed is wrong.
The key word, Herod, is context.
Yeah.
That material is presented remorselessly, day in, day out, out of context. And you, as a media reporter, have to take it at face value, as it were. And by doing that, you've immediately fallen into the trap. You're in the tar pit. There's no way out.
Yeah, yeah. And then we're forced to argue all these little points, which, in fact, just exhausts us. And then we find that there's an endless series of these little factoids that get released to the media that we have to argue against when it's not really even the most important argument, but we're sort of faced with it because they say, oh, well, latest research has shown. And then you're forced to deal with that.
It's even worse than that, which is the little factoids are often correct as factoids. It's just that they're completely meaningless in terms of climate change because they've been looked at over a short time period.
Sure.
It won't surprise you or any of your listeners that the temperature today will reach a maximum wherever you happen to be listening or living at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the minimum will be just before dawn in the morning. Now, nobody would dream of saying at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, my goodness, it's hot. If it gets any hotter, the world's going to come to an end, because they know it's going to cool down during the later afternoon and evening and that we're looking at a daily cycle. Now, similarly, in terms of global temperature, there was a warming at the end of the 20th century. Not a large untoward warming, just a typical climatic warming. Over about 20 years, it warmed by about 0.4 degrees. Now, in order to know whether that's significant or not, you have to know what climate cycle you are looking at, what part of a climate cycle. Because there are cycles on the level of annual, we know that, seasonal annual cycles. We then know there's the sunspot cycle on 11 years. We then know that there's the double sunspot cycle, which is the sun's magnetic field switching, which is 22 years. There's then a 60-year oceanographic cycle. There's another 80-year solar cycle. There's a 210-year solar cycle. There's a 1,500-year cycle, which is what the Little Ice Age and the medieval warming period are all about, and so on and so forth. And the point is all these cycles are interacting in such a way that global temperature is never constant for a very long period of time. It's quite surprising that temperature's actually been now essentially unchanged for 17 years. That's quite a long time. Temperature nearly always is either increasing or decreasing. And in due course, that will happen to the present period of temperature stasis will undoubtedly be followed by either warming or cooling. The point is, no scientist on the planet knows which. So, again, to talk of a pause is to jump into astrology and out of science.
Absolutely. Can we just return briefly to the Antarctic question, simply because it's something that's been in the news a lot with that very publicized expedition that went down there and got trapped in the ice, and they were looking at the problem of ice loss in Antarctica. I mean, what is your general assessment of this question of ice on the Antarctic ice cap itself?
Okay, well, we have to clearly distinguish, as you've done, between sea ice, which we've talked about, which occurs in both polar regions and which waxes and wanes by enormous amounts. More than 10 million square kilometres of sea ice melt and then reform each year in those areas. And we have to distinguish that from the ice caps themselves. And Greenland is actually quite small in this regard. It's only 8% of global ice volume, and most of the rest is in Antarctica. So Antarctica is the big ice cap. Now, it's got a little peninsula that sticks out towards South America called the West Antarctic Peninsula with active volcanoes along it.
Yeah.
And there has been for a number of decades now warming along that peninsula and local melting of ice. There's no indication whatsoever that's due to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's just a local weather effect. It's probably, in fact, related to warm ocean water being directed in against that part of Antarctica by oceanographic changes. Okay, so there's a little bit of Antarctica then that is at the moment and has been for a while getting warmer. But the great majority of the huge West Antarctic ice cap, sorry, East Antarctic ice cap, it's been getting cooler at the South Pole for the last 50 years. And, of course, more snow falls on inland of both these ice caps, Antarctica and Greenland, and it turns into ice, and that's how the ice caps formed.
We're just going to break. Sorry to cut you off. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're talking about climate and ice in Antarctica. Don't go away. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio, and I'm talking to my guest Bob Carter today about real climate science, real scientific skepticism, and the counteracting of politicized viewpoints that basically have an end already determined in the way the research is conducted, and comparing that to actual scientific investigation. Now, I'd just like to alert our listeners to two very important websites. One is climatechangereconsidered.com, and that is the website that has the NIPCC report and the summary for policymakers. Very important documents to get hold of, particularly the summary if you want to just get the key points and you want to be able to talk about this to other people. Definitely get that and download it. It's a PDF file. Print it out. Hand it out to your friends. I mean, it's just really, really important to get this information out. And another website is taxingair.com, which is Bob Carter's website, which I believe contains your latest book, Bob. Is that correct, taxingair.com?
That's correct. It's not just me. It's Bill Kinnamont and Martin Field, Stuart Franks, Brian Leyland, and John Spooner. It's a whole group of authors, but it provides the context that we've talked about in this program that is so missing from the public discussion on climate change.
Absolutely. Now, we've only got a few minutes left. Just rounding off on the question of the Antarctic ice there, I'll just try and summarize it. You've basically said that the Antarctic Peninsula is warming. There is some ice loss there, but the rest of Antarctica, which is the vast bulk of Antarctica, has been cooling, and there has been increased snow. So there is actually increased ice overall. Is that correct? Or?
Well, we were at the point where we might have drawn that conclusion then. But, in fact, we can't draw that conclusion for this reason. The snow that's coming down on the top of Antarctica or the top of Greenland turns into layers, of course, of ice. And that forms part of the ice cap or ice sheet itself. Now, the ice sheet, and it's flowing, it's basically a big glacier, which flows in all directions away from the centre of the ice cap and into the sea. And, of course, around the edges at higher latitudes, the ice melts. So an ice cap is a dynamic thing, like an individual glacier in a valley. You put extra snow on the top of it, but around the outside, the ice that has flowed out to that point melts. And it is the balance of that precipitating snow in the interior and the melting around the outside that determines whether the ice cap itself is growing in volume or decreasing in volume over time. Now, it's very, very difficult to measure that for an ice cap. And until recently, we didn't have methods to do it. There are now very clever geophysical methods using orbiting satellites that measure the tiny changes in gravitational field that take place if you melt ice from beneath the satellite's path. And there are many studies using this data, but all in the last 15 years or so. And some studies show that the mass seems to be increasing, and other studies show that the mass seems to be decreasing. So you can sort of take the study that suits your argument if you wish, but much more important is the general conclusion has to be that both of those ice caps are fairly close to being in equilibrium. We have no evidence. The null hypothesis would be they're in equilibrium. and we have no strong evidence that they're not in equilibrium. More to the point, NASA, which runs the two satellites that enable us to make these measurements, have recently announced that the ways that these data are being processed are not particularly accurate because we lack a fundamental knowledge of the shape of the Earth. They use a mathematical model of the shape of the Earth, and we need a better mathematical model. Now, NASA is going to put up a new satellite to do just that sometime in the next 5 or 10 years, government funding permitting. But in the meantime, the science community just has to accept that we do not actually have the capability at the moment to measure with a determinable accuracy whether those ice caps are growing or shrinking. So the null hypothesis is they're probably in about balance.
Well, thanks very much for that, Bob. That's an excellent summary of the situation, and I think it puts to bed a lot of the somewhat unfounded and sort of scaremongering talk we have about ice loss and cooling. You've just basically summarized it very clearly, and I think your evidence is very solid. It's based on solid research. Now, I want to just now expand our minds a little bit, because I want to get the audience to reflect on deep time, and don't have any time in the show to actually discuss in detail. But Bob, you're an expert in paleoclimate. You've studied the Earth's climate over millions of years. And when we look at it over that scale of time, these questions that we have about whether it's getting warmer or cooler in the latter half of the 20th century just almost appear just utterly ridiculous, don't they?
Yes. But they're not ridiculous if they were the start of, as the IPCC has consistently alleged, a phase of strong continuous warming. But unfortunately, whereas that was the prediction in 1990, that prediction has not come true, and now we've had no increase for 17 years, and indeed it's been slightly cooling for the last 10 years or so. And there are many scientists who believe we are now about to go into a cooling phase of perhaps up to half a degree over the next two decades. And the reason for that is a long-term oceanographic oscillation called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and it's linked to a similar oscillation in the Atlantic Ocean. So, and neither of those oscillations, for example, are taken into account in the computer models. So it's no surprise the computer models are predicting increased warming. Meanwhile, it's already cooling slightly, and many scientists think it will now start to cool significantly over the next decade or two.
And just very briefly, the medieval warming, the Roman warming, the Bronze Age warming, in your understanding, were these periods warmer than now, about the same now? How do they compare?
It's a difficult question because before instrumentation, we have no way, and that's about thermometers about almost 300 years old, but we've got a worldwide network of thermometers of any reliability only for about the last 150 years. So right. Prior to that, we can't actually measure a global temperature, and we have to infer it from geological observations and what are called proxy measures. And a proxy measure might be finding a tropical shellfish, for example, in an ocean core. And we can say because that shellfish lives today in warm water, we know that the water when that core, that part of the core was deposited, was warm. So using proxy measures, we know, yes, that the medieval warming, the Roman warming before it, and the Minoan warming before that were all warmer than today in Greenland, in the high Arctic region. And we know from many places in the world that a similar pattern is true, but we do not actually have a single measurement that we can refer to that shows that in the same way that we can say there was definitely a phase of warming between 1979 and 1997.
Yes.
So we're using these geological evidences, but they're very strong evidence. And if we go back a little bit before the Minoan warming, which was at about 3,500 years ago, if we go back to about 8,000 years ago, we come to a period of time which is the early part of our present warm interglacial period, called the Holocene, because that's the name for this warm period of time, the Holocene climatic optimum. And it was a climatic optimum because the temperature was in Greenland and putatively worldwide, was about a degree and a half warmer than it is today. So there's been plenty of times in the recent past, the last few thousand years, when the climate has been warmer than it is now, let alone going back into really deep time beyond that. And this is the contextual information that is not made available to the public, and it's a disgrace that it isn't.
Absolutely. And of course, not only was it warmer then, it wasn't a particularly catastrophic situation either, was it? It was a time of the flourishing of humanity. The very earliest developments in human agriculture took place at that time. It was actually what brought human civilization into existence, one might say.
The phrase halcyon days comes to come to mind, but in fact, scientists, being much more practical people, they call it a climatic optimum. That's why they call it a climatic optimum. Warm is generally good. Cold is generally bad.
Indeed.
I wonder if I might finish by just making a concluding comment, which is the reason the public find this issue so difficult is the same reason that you yourself have found it difficult, that they are presented with facts. Many times those facts are actually true, but they are presented out of context in a way that feeds alarm about global warming and completely ignores the reality that the Earth is a dynamic planet on which climate change happens the whole time. So we've got, in a sense, forces that are working against the dissemination of proper material into the public domain. And I want to quote to you what John Kennedy said, the former US president, in an address he gave at Yale University in 1962. Sure. And he said the following: "The great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. Too often we hold fast to the cliches of our forebears. We subject all facts to a prefabricated set of interpretations. We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought." End of the quotation. Now, that is absolutely apposite to what is going on in the media about climate change today.
Absolutely, and it's a brilliant set of words there. He had some great speeches, and that really summarizes it, and summarizes many other topics we talk about on this show. Bob Carter, it's been a great pleasure having you on, and I would like to have you on again. I'd like to talk to you about this on a more regular basis.
Very happy to do that, Harry Wood, and thank you for the courtesy of having me on in the first place.
Absolutely. Well, that's our show for this week. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back next week. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out.